comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
Thank you, Nina Simone, and hello, everybody. This is Eric Mann, the host of Voices from the Frontlines. I'm in studio, as always, with Channing Martinez, our producer, and we're very happy on the board is Kiana Williams, who's also helping us edit some of the programs now. And we'd like the show today, and we hope you do. First of all, we're happy to be back from Fund Drive. When I text it, it comes out Fun Drive, which isn't exactly true, but I want it to be. And for those of you who gave a lot of money to Voices and to the Strategy Center show, not you didn't give the money to us, you gave it to the KPFK, but who gave us a vote of confidence during the fund drives, that means a lot, you know. So thanks. Glad to be back doing regular scheduled programming. So one of the things, so here's a couple of things we're going to do today. The first thing is that Channing and I are really working on building up Voices from the Frontlines as a combination of a website, a newspaper, a center for programming, and we do put out, usually on Tuesday morning, we're going to try to see if we can do it Monday morning, but we usually do it Tuesday morning. We put out an email to our subscribers, that usually about 8 or 9 in the morning, that lets you know what's going to be on Tuesday at 3. It also has a link directly to our site, voicesfromthefrontlines.com. You go on there, you can see it's really a beautifully designed site. I want to thank Tanya Bernard, who did the design about 3 years ago. And you can click on and you can see all the really great shows we have. And again, Kiana and Channing and I are working to even clean up some of the past, you know, to just raise the audio value and the production value of the show. So here's a perfect example. We're about to play a clip, and it is it's a 32-minute segment that we did, we being Kiana, Channing, myself, and the main protagonist here, Zakia Sankar-Jabbar, who I'll tell you about. If you remember, 3 weeks ago during the fund drive, we had Channing and Zakia and I on. We raised $2,200 for KPFK, so you obviously liked her. And we had a whole conversation, which is the main thing we talk about at the on this show anyway, which is race, racism, why the United States is an empire, why the third world is important, the fight against racism, imperialism, and ecological disaster, and women's liberation inside the struggle against imperialism. That's what we talk about. And building movements, that's the big thing, building actual movements. So Zakia Sankar-Jabbar is a terrific grassroots leader. She, as you hear from the introduction, she founded, along with her husband, an organization called Racial Justice Now in Dayton, Ohio. She's now a national organizer for Dignity in Schools, which is fighting the school-to-prison pipeline, which we are too. Although I call it the prison-to-prison pipeline because the schools are now prisons. So for Black and Latino kids, there is no non-prison anywhere. With that, we're going to now listen to the conversation. So here's the thing. Would you please, during this interview, go on your phone or go on your computer and just simply go on voicesfromthefrontlines.com. There is an easy click to register. Is that right?
There is. Everything that you need is at the top right of the website page, beginning with going on right now and clicking to stream right now. It's right at the top. And then the second thing is our podcast. And then the third thing is sign up for a mailing list.
And after the Zakia interview, I want to talk about our podcast and talk to people about how to do that. But here's the main point. During Fund Drive, we ask for your help, and you're great. You are really great. But we want to build Voices from the Front Lines, which is called your national movement building show, into a point of reference for our listeners. So you really can, at night, download an amazing conversation with Candy Mossett for an hour, where we talk to one of the leaders of the Indigenous Environmental Network. And we understand that you're not always available from 3 to 4, but can we help build voices as an integral part of your life? Will you go on, and you can go back 6 years and hear my interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal. That was one of the best I've ever done, thanks to him, of course. So we want to continue to have Voices listeners help us build Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show, into your show, okay? With that, thank you, Kiana. So we're going to start with Zakiya Sankara Jabbar. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. Very excited. We're in studio with four people. First, with our primary guest, Zakiya Sankara Jabbar, who's an old friend of mine, or a new friend of mine, feels like an old friend of mine. She's an organizer. That's the first and most important thing about her. She helped to form an organization called Racial Justice Now in Dayton, Ohio. She's a national organizer now with the Dignity in Schools campaign. I'm Eric Mann. I'm the director of the Labor Community Strategy Center. I'm a veteran of the Congress of Racial Equality, the Newark Community Union Project, Students for Democratic Society, and the United Auto Workers. And I'm also in the studio with Jenny Martinez, one of the lead organizers of the Labor Community Strategy Center, producer of our radio show, Voices from the Front Lines, and also Kiana Williams, who's helping us put the whole show together and is working with the Strategy Center as well as Feminist Magazine. So it's four of us trying to put this whole thing together. Zakiya, very happy to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The purpose of this conversation is about the role of ideology in organizing and the role of bringing revolutionary thought back into the organizing process. So I want to frame it a little bit about what I'm trying to talk about, and then I'm going to start with Zakiya and Channing, and we're going to all talk about it together. Basically, throughout history, the only successful organizers have been revolutionaries. There's been a view that, well, the revolutionaries over here, who talks about radical ideas, revolutionary ideas, and then the organizer is the person who so-called gets down with the community and fights on daily struggles. That's a complete lie. It's anti-communist. It's anti-revolutionary. It's part of the deep counter-revolution we're living in right now, where they're rewriting history. The real history is that this system is so hard to change that the only successful organizers have been revolutionaries, and the only successful revolutionaries have been organizers. So if you are an ideologue, meaning not a person who just talks ideas, you've never been historically successful. If you're just an organizer, you're not successful either, which I'll explain. So let me just riff on a little bit. When I got involved in the civil rights movement, the movement was in a very radical period, which was 1963, 64, 65, all the way through the rest of my life. People were trying to say more radical things because they felt that there was first of all, among black people, there was tremendous internalized oppression, and there was an effort to shake people up, to agitate them intellectually. And so the role of a speaker was often to say very controversial things. So when Dr. King says the I Have a Dream speech, everybody loves that part of the speech because that is not that controversial in some ways. But don't underestimate that, because if you're a Southern racist and he says, yes, black and white are going to all be together, the Southern racist is saying we have to kill this man. So the dream itself scared the hell out of white people. But you don't know that in the speech he also said that we black people are exiles in our own land. Well, if you're exiled in your own land, that means you're an oppressed people. You are a nation. He also said that America has issued us a check, but it's turned out to come back with insufficient funds, meaning you're a bunch of liars, cheaters, and stealers. But that was how Malcolm would have said it. King doesn't talk like that. But the system knew that he was warning them. That's what you got to go listen to that speech, because that is a very radical speech. But the system wants to treat it like it was a very easy speech. Now, Malcolm, at the same time, he called it the farce on Washington.
Yes, it is.
So he wanted to push the conversation further to the left. But contrary to what people thought, he knew King was doing a better job than he indicated. But he was always trying to be the harder line in this. But here's the thing. When I joined the Congress of Racial Equality, we had chapters in every city. And the core chapters would go out and organize people. We would have members. You'd have to have a member. And most of the core people were volunteers. We didn't have a paid staff. I mean, I was paid, not that much. But we had four or five staff for the whole Northeast of the United States, five of us. And we had thousands and thousands of members. But here was the cool thing. When you went to Brooklyn Core or Bronx Core, you'd go to a meeting of 20 people. And those 20 people or 30 people, when they called a demonstration, 500 people would come out because Core had the reputation then. So I've only understood myself as an organizer. An organizer to me is somebody who wakes up in the morning, has an idea, and is part of an organization. That's the first thing. So if you're not part of an organization, you can't be an organizer. You can't be a freelancer. It doesn't make any sense. You got to be in Racial Justice Now. Now, maybe Racial Justice Now one day only had two people in it, but at least it was an organization trying to recruit people to get more people in it. So what I'm trying to get to is that today, Zakiya, a lot of the people, if you ask them what they're doing today, they say, I'm organizing, let's say, women, working class women on an issue of reproductive rights, or I'm DACA and I'm working on immigrant rights, or I'm doing, and each person will describe what they're doing based on an issue. When I was involved, the only thing we were doing, there were three questions. It was said, what's the problem? The system. What's the solution? The revolution. What's the plan? The movement. Now, after we had the problem was the system, the solution was the revolution, the plan was the movement, you still did issues. You still had to work on reproductive rights. You still had to work on housing. It's not like everybody was doing everything. Some people had areas of specialty. But we all thought we were in it together. And today, I don't think we are. So the reason I wanted to have you on the show, among many other reasons, is because I think, one, you built an organization in a reasonably, you know, an important Midwest city that a lot of people don't even hardly know about, that you built it with your bare hands out of your own experience. But you bring a lot of theory to it, a lot of history to it. So I want to get to the bottom of where'd you get that theory? Where'd you get that history from? Because you're not some innocent grassroots person who just invented this stuff yourself. That's a long introduction, but I want to now introduce a very gifted organizer and revolutionary, Zakiya Sankara-Jabbar. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm happy to be here. I'm happy that you asked me that question, and one of the things that I always say is that I was brought to this movement and to this work out of, you know, my own experience, because I questioned, simply questioning why things were happening the way that they were happening. And then I began to dig, to look for answers, right, to those questions. And so, you know, I went on this deep dive of studying, literally just reading. You know, I had a ravenous appetite all of a sudden for reading and studying, and one book led to the other and so forth. And one of the books that really changed me politically, well, let me step back. One of the things that happened that really compelled me into reading more and becoming more politicized was experiencing when my three-year-old son was being targeted in preschool, you know, behavior issues. But it was not him. It was the institution itself really criminalizing and pathologizing normal childhood behavior. And so I just did not accept the narratives of the administration and the teachers of my three-year-old child, of my baby, right? And so I remember I was in college at the time, and I did a simple Google search. I was in JSTOR. For folks who've been in college, they know what JSTOR is. And I said, African-American boys in education.
Right.
And you can imagine all the articles, all the books, all of the stuff that came up. And one of them, interestingly enough, came up was Dr. Juwanza Kanju for the conspiracy to destroy black boys. And so he's an educator. He's still alive. He's in Chicago. And, you know, black educators had long been talking about, you know, how black children had been targeted in schools, right? And talking about curriculum and making sure that children are seeing themselves in the curriculum and all these different things. And so at that time, I didn't know anything about that, but I read that book in 2 days and really ran through it. And like I said, and got into other books and other theory and so forth. And so now I continue to read, I continue to study. And one of the people who has had one of the most impact on my political development is Amos Wilson. He wrote a book called Blueprint for Black Power. It's one of his, it was his magnum opus. The book is about 1,000 pages long. I have not finished it. I'm still, you know, working through it. But that gave me a lot of ideas around Pan-Africanism, black nationalism, and the women even in the black nationalist movement, right? And so that's something that has helped to give me the political foundation for Racial Justice Now, that is still a thriving organization based in Dayton, Ohio.
Now, I want you to go back because, you know, sometimes the stories are so heartbreaking, I can almost bear to hear them. But imagine if I can't bear to hear them, you had to hear it every day. Tell us the story of what happened to your 3-year-old son. I'm glad we started with the theory and then come back to the experience, if you know what I mean. But your 3-year-old son, your 3-year-old black son, is unfortunately a story of millions of black boys,
millions.
Right? So, but still, tell us that story.
Yeah, again, I was a student at the time at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, on the outskirts there. And he was doing fine. I had him in a child care center that was near where we lived. But when I started, you know, going back to school to get my education, there was a child care center on the campus. And I said, oh, wow, this is great. You know, I heard really, you know, good things about it. You know how as parents, you know, you want your child to have the best of the best that you can possibly give them. And so I signed him up. I immediately started running into roadblocks. When I wanted to get him into the school, I had to find out that there was only a certain number of students' children that they will allow in, especially if you were getting something called Title 20. So Title 20 is a federal program that provides child care assistance for parents if you're working or if you're in school. And so they paid for the vast majority of his child care, which is something I couldn't afford. It was $1,000 a month or so back then, or maybe more. But they paid for the vast majority of his child care while I was working, while I was in school. And so what the center was saying that, you know, we're only going to take so many of these subsidized kids. That's actually how they talked to me, you
right.
know, and I'm just like, oh, okay. And so I, you know, I pushed it aside because my eyes were on the prize, so to speak. You know, I can deal with, you know, what is, I guess, now known as microaggressions, macroaggressions, whatever, you know. And so I got him in. I was aggressive, you know, because they were basically doing everything that they could to discourage me from entering into that school. Once they finally admitted him, I'm not exaggerating, literally a week later, I mean, these people were calling me while I'm sitting in class. Oh, we're having this problem. We're having that problem, you know. You should come pick him up. And I'm sitting in class. This is supposed to be my child care, you know, while I'm in class. And so one of the things that when I would get there and I would ask, I said, well, what's the problem? You know, oh, he's having problems transitioning. And I said, what does that even mean? You know, and so one of the things that they said, well, when we're doing one activity, we only do it for a certain amount of minutes. And then you have to move to the next activity and he doesn't want to move. And I literally, and I stood there and I just stared. I was like, that's what you're calling me for. What are you talking about? You know, and I said, what is abnormal about that? He likes the activity. Can you guys find, I mean, you know what I mean? He likes doing it. Can you encourage him? And what is it that he likes, you know? And so I just questioned everything. You know, they wanted to pathologize. No, you know, he should be, you know, going with this or he should be doing this. And I, you know, they're saying this is, you know, something that we can be concerned about. He may have a disability just off of that.
Wow.
And here's what really turned on the red light for me. They said, well, our School of Professional Psychology can come see him for free. I said, wait, psychology? I said, what do you mean? I said, is he crazy? He's three, you know? And I said, if you want somebody from the School of Psychology to come see him, that means he's abnormal, right? I said, can you tell me what normal behavior is? What is happening here? And they could never answer that question. And I remember the teachers who were white, the white women, the administrator was white, and they were, again, white women. And so they just basically abhorred the fact that I had the nerve to even question them because it was a great school.
The voice you're hearing is Zakiya Sankara Jabbar. The story you're hearing is about the attack on a three-year-old beautiful black boy who happens to be her son. I'm sorry, you know, it's insane, right?
I didn't understand like what was happening.
If Kafka was black, we would better understand the book. Keep going.
Yeah. No, I mean, no that's insane. Absolutely. It was very insane. And the good thing for me is, again, I kept searching.
You were great.
Researching, and I finally came up on the very first study Dr. Walter Gilliam did on preschool expulsions in private preschools. And I said, oh, wow, you know, because I had started to internalize some of this. This is what happens to black women at the time I was single, you know, newly divorced. And, you know, because they had already made me feel a certain kind of way because I was getting this subsidy program, you know, welfare program, you know, all the connotations that happens with that with black right. women and, you know, you're a welfare queen and all this other stuff, despite the fact that I'm actually in college, right? You know, those are the kind of, you know, signals that you get from these people. And so I had started to question myself, you know, is there something I'm doing wrong? You know, what's going on? You know, is there something really wrong with my son? And I kept going back to the fact, no, there's nothing wrong with me, and there's nothing wrong with my son. There's something sick about this environment that he's in. And I remember saying that in a meeting, and they were shocked. Like the administrator, and they threatened me. And they said, well, if you don't sign these papers for him to be seen by a psychologist, then he's still going to have to get out of the school. Now, in the meantime, I'd taken him to his pediatrician. His pediatrician was done. She's like, what? You know, she's like, don't you ever sign, you know, come talk to me first. You know, his other child care provider was working at night, going to school in the day. She said, no, he's a great child. You know, I've never had any problems. And in fact, she even came to the meeting with me that I had with the school administrators, and she challenged them on everything. You know, she was an older black woman. She said, look, I've raised six black boys on my own. I've been doing child care for 30 years. I don't know what you all are talking about. There's nothing wrong with this child. So, no, I mean, she was great. I had allies. She actually encouraged me, this older black woman who was his child care provider where I worked at night. It was really a tough road emotionally, you know, mentally dealing with this. I eventually filed my own civil rights complaint with the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. Then they referred me because they said they had no purview over state education or private education facilities in the state of Ohio. So they referred me to the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights. I filed a complaint there. It wasn't a priority under the outgoing Bush administration at that time, incoming Obama's administration. So I went and talked to Professor Vernelia Rander, who's a co-founder with me of Racial Justice Now. She is amazing elder. I've always seemed to align with elders. I think about that now just sitting here. And she was an activist professor at the University of Dayton School of Law. She fought for black students on that university's campus. Dayton is a very conservative town in Southwest Ohio. The universities are very, very conservative. And so she started, you know, one of the first, you know, black student unions for black law students so that they would survive at that university. And so I had known her in the community. She didn't stay in the ivory tower. She's very community centric. She was always out in the community. Her expertise was health disparities in African Americans. And so when I remember I called her, I was in a panic. I said, what do I do? You know, I'm filing these complaints. I'm trying to fight. She said, we've got to organize. She said, we have got to change the policies and practices that allow them to do this to our kids. And that is the inception and how Racial Justice Now was founded. Because she said, and we have to explicitly name race as the issue. You know, we can't get around this whole post-racial. We were totally against this idea that, you know, there was anything post-racial about America. You know, I had went to our local NAACP. I went to the traditional rights, civil rights organizations. They couldn't help me. And she said, we just can't get around it. And that's how Racial Justice Now was born. You know, we started to organize black parents at that school and eventually all around the city. And first of all, we were interviewing them. And it was almost like a sigh of relief that it just wasn't me, because so many black women feel like that. Like, am I just going through this? Is something really wrong with my kid? Is there something wrong with me? And it was really affirming, almost, even though it was sad to hear that this was happening to so many black children. It was really affirming to hear from other black women that they had been experiencing this. And we almost created really a support system for each other, you know, that we weren't the only ones, that they had a home at Racial Justice Now, what became even a political home. We strategized together, and we had some huge victories in just a few short years.
You know, the whole issue of, if you read Frantz Fanon, of course, and the whole question of colonialism making the colonized subject feel that they're crazy. He treated both the oppressor and the oppressed. Now, the oppressor, the white French, felt guilty about all the pain they were inflicting, but they didn't feel that guilty, and they didn't have real issues of their own self-esteem. They had still a belief in their own superiority. Mm-hmm. The oppressed just despised themselves. And this was a psychological, so he wrote, of course, as you know, The Wretch of the Earth, saying, wait a minute, it's a system to make you despise yourself.
Right.
That's the point. You are beautiful. So when black, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, what? Black people, or I am sane, you are insane. So that if we do not flip the script on
That's
them,
right.
If we don't put the finger back in their face. So here you are, one of the most, you know, you're a pretty brilliant person and such an insightful person. And yet the conversation inside of you was a lot, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes. That was a lot of what was happening because, you know, I mean, the way that they talk to you is a projection, like, oh, no, we're perfect here. No, this is mini university. You know, because they have great marketing and propaganda campaigns to, you know, really convince parents, you know, that this is where you want your child to be. But then when you're a black poor person, you know, and you're getting higher education, oh, no, we ain't talking about you. You know, no, you stop right here. This is for the elite that can afford it, you know, the white people here and whoever could afford it. And so they don't say that explicitly. It comes up in other ways. They you know, all these barriers, you know, they make you question, you know, do I even want to, you know, go to this school? Here's the thing, and one of the things that I've had an opportunity to really reflect on is that now that I am politicized, I would not even choose that school
today. Of course,
today.
That's right.
You know, what we've been socialized to believe is what's good is usually what's related to what's white, right?
That's right.
What is a good school? You know, it might be a good school for this particular population of kids. But if it's not working for black and brown children, black children in particular, it's not a good school. Okay.
Well, just on a very concrete thing,
yeah.
You know, I have three black grandchildren, you know.
Right.
My grandson, Raider, was going to this very progressive school that was significantly white.
Mm.
And my daughter got him out of there because it was still having a very negative, I won't go into some of the details, on his own self-esteem.
Yeah.
So he's now in a school called the Open School. The Open School, first of all, he was there with his other two black cousins, Ava and Layla. So that was even cool. But he's now in a majority black, Latino, Asian school. So what I'm getting to is the perniciousness
mm-hmm.
of white racist culture on the identity of black children is so difficult.
It's overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
There's
right?
research that supports that. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, just overwhelming. So now let's talk about why we do what we do. Well, this is why we do what we do.
Of course.
So you had this oppression. You did Google the revolution. You did find a you found a good, I mean, you're a very great, you are an autodidact. You are really tremendous, as you say. I always tell people there's three ways to beat the system. Read, read, and read.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
After that, arm yourself and all those other things. But start with this reading. Tell us about a little bit more about ideas, either verbally that you were given or other people's ideas that unlocked your own ideas that made you think, wait a minute, I get it now. As you said, one of them is, I don't even want to go to that school. How did I even think I wanted to go to that school? But tell me more about other thought leaders who have influenced you, and then we're going to go into the organizing work, okay?
Yeah. Oh, man, there's so many different thought leaders, and I'm obviously, you know, still reading and still learning. Asa Hilliard, Dr. Asa Hilliard was another educator. He was a professor of African-American studies and education at Georgia State University. And so he wrote a lot of curriculum back in the early 80s and 90s when they were pushing not necessarily ethnic studies, but I think it evolved out of the push for African-centered education in this country, the Council of Independent Black Schools, and all of those different things. So those are some of the – Barbara Sizemore as well, who's another educator. She's the first black woman to be a chancellor of Washington, D.C. public schools. And they I remember reading about her. She said they got rid of me quick because she said, I was like, I'm going to make sure black children learn. And she said, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to say that, you know, that was going to be my focus. And yeah, she lasted 18 months, I believe, but she still went down in history as the first black woman chancellor for D.C. public schools. So these are some black thought leaders, educators in particular, who have been very influential on me. And the ideas of also Sankofa, right, and going back and learning more about our history. Malcolm, I mean, that clip that we listened to just earlier today, still very relevant, you know, and I remember one of his quotes is, you know, who taught you to hate yourself? I literally had to dig in and deal with that because we're all socialized in this country to be anti-black, you know, and there's anti-blackness permeates this culture worldwide, really.
And you know, so, it's funny because I'm a Jew, and when I was in high school, I got beat up for being a Jew. It's a long story I'll tell you about. But what I noticed is what they say about you. They say things about your physical appearance. They say things about your culture, you know. Even when I listen to people, including black people, say, he Jewed me out of something. Like, that means you're a cheating, lying, stealing Jew. And we got to never let that happen, right? So you learn that there, and then you have to. What I learned from my mother, this is a good thing. My mother was a fierce anti-fascist. And I'll tell the story over and over again, but this kid said that I killed Christ, right, when I was 5 years old. So I went to my mom and I said, did we kill Christ and who is Christ? And she said, who told you that? I said, Jackie Morris. She says, all right, where's his mother? She said, I said, she grabbed me by the ear and pulled me over. We're going to go see Mrs. Morris. She marched over to Jackie Morris's mother and says, you anti-Semite, you fascist, you Nazi. How dare you? She says, what are you talking about? She says, you told my son that he killed Christ. She says, I don't know where my son heard that from. She said, from you. So, in an interesting story, 10 years later, I'm in Valley, no, 20 years later, I'm in Valley Stream, Long Island, in a white suburb. I'm at Cornell now, my freshman year. My dearest friend, Angel Flemings, who was black, we were in the first group to get black people admitted to Cornell. There were only 10 black students. So Angel Fleming's father comes. He's an entomologist who at the U.S. Army, you know, is Dr. Flemings, right? He nicely drives Angel to my house in Valley Stream. As he gets out, my neighbor's kid calls him the N-word.
Oh, wow.
He knocks on the door of the room. He says, excuse me, ma'am, your son called me this N-word. She said, I don't know where he heard it. He put his finger in her face and said, he heard it from you, and you should be profoundly ashamed of yourself. That's it. And he walked away. My point is teaching people that they're the ones who are screwed up early on in the game to tell our children, we got to go to war with these people. We're not going to let them, because if we let the aggression come into us, we're going to hate ourselves. Aggression is essential psychologically. So when I joined the black movement, I thought I was angry. I said, this is nothing. Now I see the level of anger needed. Yeah. We've lost that. Back to what we were saying on the other show today about what was the word we used? Passion and, no, there's another
urgency.
Word.
But
urgency.
Yeah.
That we have to make other people feel uncomfortable. We have to put the moral challenge to them, which I think is going to be good for our children, and teach
right.
them that you it's not enough to not experience racism. The only way you can defeat racism, because it's endless, is to go on the offensive against it.
Right.
And that's what Fanon taught, and I believe that with all my heart as a psychological construct. Do you agree with that?
Yes. No, I definitely think you have to. I think it's both and. I think, you know, it has to be offensive and defensive.
Right.
I often struggle with this, you know, term, especially a lot of people label black nationalists in particular reactionary. What does that mean? I mean, you know, I'm like, okay, so are you not supposed to respond to some of these horrible things that's happening? I mean, when the cops kill our kids in the street. You know, I'm concerned that there's not more of a reaction, right? I'm concerned that there's not that more sense of an urgency. I'm really concerned, and you're right, we talked about that. I'm really concerned that there has been this sort of socialized apathy towards what's happening. Like there's this idea, you know, at least in a subset of our people, that there's really nothing we can do about it. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people, you know, working as an organizer with Racial Justice Now, there ain't really nothing we can do about it, you know. And I'm like, no, you know. I think one of the quotes that I used in my email for years was from Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any. And you have to start off with the belief that you can make a change. You know, it is psychological, that you are not the problem. You don't internalize the oppression, and that you put it back on the feet, you know, on where it lies. Granted, it seems insurmountable, but I think you have to first believe you can do something about it. That has to at least be the start. You have to believe you can change it.
Well, all you can say is, wow, Zakiya Sankar-Jabbar is just a brilliant political analyst. And I want you to see if you liked what she had to say. And as a host, I want to say that I'm in some way sorry I spoke too long a few times. I will not do such a long introduction in the future. But you have to understand a little bit, so not just to apologize, is that we were mainly talking to each other in that room. We were not focusing on production values. She and I are close friends, and there was Kiana and Channing, and the thing went on for about 2.5 hours, and we were all kind of riffing. But in the future, I mean that. I want to make sure that when I have a guest as great as she is, that my introduction could be a lot tighter. So I learn from doing this job, and so I want to get your response in a minute, Channing, before we go on to Barbara. But help if you like this magazine we're trying to do, this online national movement building show, this website that could be a movement organizer. We need your help. We really do. So the first thing we need you to do is to subscribe to the actual show going on the website. So maybe because we're going to be sending you stuff, and when you get the weekly email, there is a link to the show and so forth. But maybe, Channing, just talk a minute about that and talk about a minute about your reaction to Zakiya, and then we'll go to Barbara.
Sounds great. So there's a lot of great updates going on Voices, and we're always updating the site so it looks beautiful, as always. And so if you go to voicesfromthefrontlines.com, you can sign up right on the front page. And you can virtually sign, if you even Google Voices from the Frontlines, you will find a sign up on any one of our sites. You'll find it on Facebook, you'll find it on Twitter, you'll find it on our website, you'll find it on Instagram, everything you can think of. You'll find it on Apple iTunes podcasts, you'll find it on FeedBurner, and we will soon be on SoundCloud in a few weeks as well. So very exciting updates, and we are planning to send you a lot more things. And so do sign up on our website. And then for Zakiya, the first thing I want to say is do note that this is part of an ongoing series because we did tape for 2 hours. So this is the first segment of that. And there are other segments to come. And there are so many thoughts I have. I mean, one thing that you were saying, in a sense, in the podcast was tell your kids that it's a war not to be submissive was one thought that came up to my head. Going to the tradition of, you know, the black mother saying, when an officer stops you, just be very respectful and be very submissive and say, yes, sir. And, you know, it's those are good things that for a child to learn, of course, right? But at the same token, we've seen so many people murdered saying, yes, sir, saying by law, officer, I'm by law notifying you that I have a gun in my car, right? For like Philando Castro, who was shot anyways, because that's what he was supposed to do by law, right? Sure. And so that was one thing that stood out to me is like, tell your kids that we're in a war. Don't tell them to just be submissive, but understand that, you know, there's a war and these people are racist. They're not right.
Or as the grandmother says on Blackish, remember, they all hate you.
Exactly.
So in that context, we're gonna segue to Barbara Lott Holland and let Barbara, you on with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Barbara. So Barbara Lott Holland and Kiana, you're gonna get the last word. So get ready for whatever you want to say later. I'm giving you a heads up. So what we do is, I mean, the Strategy Center does a lot of things, right? We are what we call a movement-building organization. We're a predominantly black and Latino organization. We're a multiracial organization, but predominantly black and Latino. And we focus heavily right now in South Los Angeles, in particular the black areas of South Los Angeles, because all of our members think that the central contradiction in Los Angeles today is first the police state and secondly the attacks on black people. The facts that we want to, you know, so one of our slogans is gentrification is genocide. And under the statutes, it really means under the UN statutes that part of genocide is the forced dispersal and government attacks on a population. It doesn't have to be simply murder. It can be driving people out of the workforce, arresting them so often that they move to Palmdale and San Bernardino and driving the black population out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the Strategy Center has a campaign right now. It's called, first, free public transportation. Number two, no cars in LA. Number three, no police on the buses and trains. Number four, no police in the schools. And five, stop the MTA attacks on black passengers. So that's our campaign. Now, as an organizer, Barbara, so the first thing again is we need you to send us an email at, you can do Eric at Voices from the Front Lines or info at the Strategy Center. Do info at the Strategy Center.org if you want to get involved in this campaign. Is that right?
That's right.
Info at the Strategy. So if you want, see, close your eyes and see if you know the five demands. Close your eyes. What's the first one? Free public transportation. Great. What's the second one? No cars, no aid. What's the third one? No police on the trains and buses. What's the fourth one? No police in the schools. What's the fifth one? Stop the attacks on black passengers. If you can memorize five sentences and want to work with us, send us an email at info@thestrategycenter.org. Now, Channing and Barbara and another organizer named India Monet Tate, among others, there's also another organizer named Carlos Elmo Gomez, we're working in Roosevelt High School, we're working in Augustus Hawkins High School with the students. We're working at a high school in South LA called Ouchie, and we're working on the trains. So, Barbara, I want to just tell us what you're doing on the trains and how bad is MTA racism against black people on the trains?
Oh, good evening, everyone. So the first thing that we're doing on the trains is letting the passengers on the train know that there is definitely attack on black riders, that there is an organization out there that is fighting to decriminalize people that use public transportation. We are out there also to let people aware that we are the organization that is fighting for free public transportation. We are fighting for no police on public transportation and no police in our schools. And, as you said, to stop the attack on black people. And this is an everyday thing. And some of the writers, there is a mixed bag of writers out there, which we know. We are talking to people on public transportation who have very oppressed lives. We have people that see police from the time they walk to their corner, if not riding by their street, to the time they get off of one form of transportation to get on another form of transportation to get off and get on another form of transportation. The majority of people that ride public transportation are lower-income people making $15,000 to $20,000 a year, and their commute in the morning, very few of us, because I ride public transportation myself, very few of us has the luxury of only having to get on one form.
So tell us about some people. Tell us about some people you meet on the train, real people.
Real people we meet on the train. We meet on the train a lot of people that are looking for work. The majority of people that are on the train is looking for work. There are a lot of people that's on the train that don't have anywhere to go, so they ride public transportation in order to stay out of harm's way, or so they think. We run into people on public transportation that's just getting out of being incarcerated and is trying to make their way back home before they see another law enforcement. We see mothers on the train with their children trying to get their kids to either school, daycare, before they move on to their day job.
Now, one of the things that's going on is that the MTA has these so-called codes of conduct. So what's happening is the MTA is, I'll go right back to you, Barbara, is criminalizing everyday behavior and also criminalizing the failure to pay fare, which they call fare evasion. What's it like? Explain to us concretely what has been the experience of some people with the police. Because we're talking about 30,000 people have gotten tickets this year, over 50% of whom are black.
Right. We have the experience of people that are low income. They really, honestly, they cannot afford the fare. They do not have the first $1.75 for their first leg of travel, let alone a $7 for a day pass or $100 for a monthly pass. So they are jeopardizing their freedom, according to MTA's codes of conduct, which is not even legal. How do you get incarcerated and cited for something that's not even a law? They have to decide every day when they get up, what can they afford to pay for today? Can they afford to give their kids lunch money? Can they afford to buy supper when they come home? Can they afford to take a chance and pay this $1.75 and hope somebody will give them a ride home or at least in walking distance from their home in order not to be cited or even arrested?
So, Janet, go from there.
So one good example was that during the summer we were on the trains every day,
right.
When we were on there with HBCU interns, part of our HBCU program. And
explain what HBCU is.
The Historically Black College and Universities. And that's a longer story, but I'll get into that later.
Sure.
But basically, there was one woman, for example, who was getting on the train, and she only had enough money for herself, but she had her two-year-old daughter, and they had to go to school. She was taking her daughter to school. I kid you not, the officer came up to her to check their fare, and the officer gave the two-year-old daughter a ticket for not having her fare. That's how bad it is, and that's just one of the lightest situations, right? We've had situations where a young man was just sitting on the station waiting for the train, and the officer told them that you have to hurry up and go. He's waiting for the train. He's not loitering. The officer told him that he was loitering, and he came back and circled back twice and gave him a ticket for waiting on the train, basically. And there's numerous of terrible incidents that we can tell you.
So 30,000 to 40,000.
Right. We have our own experience of being organizers, civil rights organizers, and being confronted and possibly cited by the police for talking to people and telling them about their rights, trying to push us off the train. And we, of course, we fight back and say, you are violating my civil rights. And I had one incident where I was talking to this young woman, and he was telling me I was bothering her, and she got it right away and said, she is not bothering me. Please give me one of your flyers. I want one of your flyers. Because
she did.
She got the incident that was happening. So, and again, as Channing was saying, these are things that happen to our people all the time. Or even when you can have a valid tap card and the machine isn't working and you're still getting a citation. And in order to prove that, you now have to take off a day from work, go down to this lonely, deserted transit court, which is against the law, to fight for what is right, to fight MTA on an error. And the thing about this, you got to pay to prove that you were right.
No, that's great, Barbara. And you know, so several things. Let me say that we are trying to bring a federal lawsuit. The Labor Community Strategy Center is looking into bringing a federal lawsuit against the MTA. But you need to know that the courts are not our friend. And if even if we win, it's going to take years. So we need you to get involved, especially, like, let's start. If you're a black passenger who's ever had a bad experience on the train, who feels that you've either been harassed by the police and you can document it, were you arrested by the police for, we don't care what happened, were you arrested on the train? Were you ever given a ticket in a racial, you know, and we think they're all racial, send us an email at info@thestrategycenter.org, and Barbara and Channing and Indy will get in touch. What's the phone number they should call?
Yeah, if you can also call us right now at 323-903-6238.
Say it again.
323-903-6238.
Now, one of the things we're trying to continue to do with the show is if we say, please send us an email at info@thestrategycenter.org, we really need you to do that. If we need you to call us, even if you say, I know somebody else who had the experience, because we're looking for people who are what's called declarants in a civil rights case, someone who could say, I had this experience, I want to testify on behalf of all the black people and all the Latinos and all the people of all races who are getting terrible treatment on the trains, but especially blacks and Latinos. We need you to go on WWW Voices from the Front Lines and register. Are we able to measure, like, let's say 341 people registered today. That's a joke. I wish they were. Can we measure that?
Yes.
We would know that?
Yes.
All right. Channing would know that?
Yes.
All right. That's
so
important.
So I'm keep that in mind. I'm watching. So do sign up today.
And if you send it to info@thestrategycenter.org, you can say, hey, Channing, right?
Yeah.
You can write the email to Channing and say, I signed up on the site and I want to get involved in this campaign. Kiana, any thoughts?
One thing that I would like to add is that what we're seeing pretty much is just the commandeering of our civil rights. It's the nation's commandeering of our civil rights. And I think this is just another demonstration of that. We should all be very mindful of that and all of the ways in which it's carried out. And being heavily policed on public transportation is one of those ways in which our civil rights is just being subtly taken away. But we can't look at it as just a small thing, or it's just the train system, where it's just this, it's a product of a larger intent. And I think it's extremely important that we never take it lightly and never think it's just one instance, where it's never itemized. It's part of a larger receipt.
And Barbara, what's it been like for you being an organizer now?
It has been a whirlwind experience. I have some very good days where I'm talking to people. They are very enthusiastic about it. And then I have days where people have been so touched by the system that they are afraid, literally afraid, to fight back. And we are working to change that. I was listening to what Zakiya was saying, and it is true. First of all, you have to believe that something can be done about it. You have to want to fight back. This is not the time to say that let somebody else do it. It must start with you.
Yeah, well, that's what we're looking for. You know, I mean, Barbara got involved by coming off the train, coming off the buses. Channing got involved as early as Crenshaw High School.
That's right, yeah.
And India Monet Tate came up from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and she went to Tougaloo College in Jackson, Mississippi, and then Channing went down and interviewed her at the HBCU annual climate justice campaign, and I interviewed her on the phone, and she's now up here with her two-year-old son, daughter, Kalani, and she's part of the Strategy Center, too. So we're looking for members. We're looking for organizers. We're looking for people that have had bad experiences that we want to turn into good experiences. So we need you. info@thestrategycenter.org if you'd like to help us. Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. Go on, more important, so go on voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Register so we know you're there, and then we're going to send you weekly, including action items, not simply the next show, but we're going to try to build our weekly newspaper more like a little newspaper, you know what I mean? So it'll say, here's what's on the show, and maybe here's one thing to do. Our website has things that you can do. Is that right? It has
yeah,
campaigns.
That is right.
So, Channing, you get the last words and say goodbye to folks.
Go to our website. It's very exciting. There are plenty of shows to visit. We also have an online bookstore, so you can also buy a lot of our literature, including Playbook for Progressives and Katrina's Legacy. And you can read a lot of different articles that we've written as well. So do sign up on our mailing list.
Take good care of yourself, and all power to the people. Eric Mann with Channing Martinez, Barbara Lott Holland. Thank you, Zakiya Sankara-Jabbar. And thank you, Kiana Williams. We'll see you next Tuesday at 4. This has been Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. All power to the people.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention.
Annihilation, a film that will amaze you. They said nothing comes back, but for the first time, something did. Lena, a biologist and former soldier, joins a mission to uncover what happened to her husband inside Area X, a sinister and mysterious phenomenon that is expanding across the American coastline. Once inside, the expedition discovers a world of mutated landscape and creatures as dangerous as it is beautiful. Annihilation stars Natalie Portman, Oscar Isaac, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. In theaters February 23rd, and you are invited to call 818-985-2711 to request a pair of available passes to a selected screening of your choice at the Landmark Theater on Pico if you are a Film Club member, or to subscribe and join the KPFK Film Club and become a member and enjoy the fun. Find out more about the Annihilation movie on Facebook.
Good afternoon for the KPFK Newsroom. I'm Dan Fritz with the daily 4 p.m. news headlines. A new security system is being tested at the 7th Street.